Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com. A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, my fan friends. Welcome to another Rahalastapa Book Club. We are joined by the esteemed academic Janina Ramirez. Hello, Nina. How are you doing?
Could you have made my Polish first name sound any more Spanish? I'll come back to why that's funny, but yeah, thank you for that wonderfully Spanish sounding introduction.
Well, it sounds like a Spanish, I know it isn't, but yeah, there is a Spanish connection. And the book is called Femina, which, that's right how you pronounce it, isn't
yeah,
it?
I suddenly
started thinking, is it Femina? But it's because I've been doing a read for something else that had two possible readings, but yeah, Femina. And it's a new history of the Middle Ages through the women written out of it.
Here it is. I've got it next to me.
I've got one as well. Look, mine's signed by the author. I haven't read it. I've listened to the audiobook, so it's a pristine copy of the book there. But I listened over the last few weeks, and while I was walking around as I walked to my venue at the Edinburgh Fringe, I would listen to 30 minutes and 30 minutes back. So I listened to sort of an hour a day in Edinburgh. Not quite, because it can't be 12 hours long, but I pretty much got through it in the Edinburgh Fringe. But yeah, it's a very interesting book. And I guess what's interesting about, well, it's that very thing that you're writing a history of people who are written out of history. And these are women. But what was it that, what was the impetus and starting point of this book for you?
Well, firstly, thank you for letting me accompany you reading the audiobook around Edinburgh. It is my own voice, which I find I can't listen to, so well done for having the patience to go through it. Everything I've ever really done, because I've written books before. I've written children's books, I've written academic books. I work as an academic at Oxford, so I teach regularly, and I make documentaries and do media work around history. And I've been doing all this for, well, my eldest is now 13. I started doing TV when he was a baby. So yeah, God, 13 years of making these things. And yet in all those years, I knew what I was doing intuitively. I know I've always been looking for underdogs in history. I know I've always been looking for the stories that are lesser told, the roads less trodden. I know I've always been an interdisciplinary medievalist. I love combining text and image and objects and archaeology. And yet I'd never synthesized it all together. I'd never sat down and thought, what's my actual method? What am I actually doing? And then I wanted to write something big about women being written out, because what I realized is, I mean, I've written another book this year as well about called Goddess, which is about goddesses that have been across the world. And I realized that by casting the lens on this sort of 50% of the human population that is not there, not as visible, I could draw in all the other people I wanted to find as well, and look for these sort of ways of doing history that haven't been done before. And can developments in technology, can developments in DNA and science actually move us forward in this rather kind of staid discipline of history? Can we bring these things together? And so women were the focal point, but so much more came out in the process. And I think the other thing as well, which is I was weaned on the Monty Python films, and I as a medievalist in my 40s now, I still have a tendency to sort of visualize the Middle Ages as Holy Grail kind of, you know, peasants in a muddy field, but also this idea of superstition, of witchcraft, of castles and knights and quests. I still sometimes have to catch myself and go, no, the Middle Ages were like we are now, just earlier. And there's the same amount of diversity. There's the same amount of complexity. That it's not all about church and state. You can't simply divide people up into brackets. If there was as much individuality and an expression of ideas then as there is now. And so that's the other reason I wanted. That's why it's called A New History of the Middle Ages. I wanted to kind of hope that the takeaway at the end of this book was, oh, wow, women did amazing things. But also, oh, wow, the Middle Ages were really interesting. And why have I not seen them this way before? I just set myself some big aims, really.
Yeah, but it is, and I guess that's what's interesting is, I mean, you talk about it's sort of, history is obviously a bit, there are gatekeepers of history, which include the historical figures themselves. You talk about, you know, one king writing out his sister out of history and rewriting history, but also by historians, who are obviously more recently have been predominantly white, middle-class, middle-aged men who are writing about other men. And so it is interesting that the new forms of a DNA analysis and that sort of thing can give us a little glimpse into the stuff that's been lost.
Yeah, I think, one of the things I say in the book that I'm thinking about for the next book now is this idea of who writes history, and how does it come down to us? And I've ended up with this sort of almost Darwinian feeling about what evidence survives the test of time, like how it comes down. If it serves the next generation, if it serves the agenda of those in power in coming generations, it's more likely to be copied. It's more likely to survive. And those things that aren't of interest to, say, 19th century colonialists or 20th century people rallying soldiers, if those things aren't useful, they simply get lost or die out. So when I first started this book, I thought there'd be the big bad white man kind of writing women out of history, quite deliberately burning things and destroying things. And that's where the name comes from as well, Femina, because it's a annotation that's appears in library records where library objects, actual books and texts, are lost. But they're sort of like a receipt to say that it once existed. And some of the different annotations are things like witchcraft, heresy. So you know those haven't survived. And the one used to designate a female author is Femina. And those don't tend to survive. So it's this idea of, I could see this like, oh, yes, we've been stamped out of history. Boom, boom, boom. I'm angry. But in fact, what I've noticed is it's a lot more organic and slow. And the loss of the rights of women sort of marry up to the loss of evidence about women from the past. There's a sense that as we're getting closer, I start the book with the suffragettes, I start the book with Emily Wilding Davison, who ran out at the Derby in 1913 and to protest for the rights of women. And they were fighting at a time where women's rights were really at a low point. And that's what I think, we tend to think that history only ever goes like this. It's only ever increasing and getting better. And the rights of women started off as zero. And then by the time we get to the 1900s, it's kind of reaching upwards. That wasn't the case. They didn't see it like that at all. They'd seen it that slowly women's rights have been eroded and they were fighting to get them back. So I think, again, that's a kind of different way of thinking about it. But in the process of that, it is, there is a sense of gatekeepers. There is a sense of people blocking out these stories. But in many cases, it's because they're simply not of interest. Isn't that sad? Yeah. It's like simply they're not interested in what women from the past did. They, you know, they want to know what big soldiers and warriors and generals were doing because that better serves those in power.
Yeah.
And I think this also, you know, you're a historian, Rich, as well. And it's...
I sure am.
You sure are. And you sure are. There's a sense about truth, which I'm constant. This is my late night at the pub, had far too much to drink. And I throw out the question at the table. Is there anything as truth? Is anything true? Is time true? Is science true? And this idea of a true historical text or a true historical account, I'm increasingly thinking that's just not the case. You know, a car crashes into a pedestrian crossing and you've got 20 witnesses. You ask each one of those witnesses what they saw and they'll have each seen something differently. They'll have each account, you've given a different account. And that's the same with our historical documents. We can't say, well, this one is absolutely the truth, because it's still going to be filtered through one individual's viewpoint, isn't it?
It is. And you make the point in the book that this is you're kind of happily saying, well, this is the viewpoint of someone who's looking at societies as more diverse and who isn't racist and who's inclusive, it's as much a viewpoint as anything else. But the issue is, I suppose, that not many people like you throughout the history of history have been able to comment or say this is what I'm interested in. So history did become this sort of dry discipline, and as you say, about only because it's easier, I suppose, to find out about that, but it is also about the interest, isn't it? There's more records of things. It's interesting that the things that trigger a lot of these stories are either, you know, the DNA analysis of burials where suddenly we discover skeletons that maybe people thought were men are actually women, but also finding Marjorie Kemp's autobiography in a cupboard while you're searching for ping pong balls in a stately home. And that's, you know, that's the chance of history, isn't it? That that Marjorie Kemp's text only survived and everyone tried to destroy it, but this one copy, you know, got squirreled away somewhere and luckily didn't get burnt as the owner wanted to do. So we still have it, you know, but it's only chance that we have what is possibly the first autobiography ever written by anyone.
In the English language, exactly. And it's it is chance. But I think what's really interesting is I couldn't have written this book 5 years ago, even, I don't think. Certainly not 10 years ago. The developments that have happened is they're twofold. On the one hand, we've got these incredible developments in science and technology. But on the other hand, we've got the internet, which is allowing the spreading of information for free across the world instantly. So if something like the Loftus Princess, when it was discovered, if that was discovered now, it would be out on Twitter. I'd see a post about it. I'd know about it right away, as opposed to the way I found out about it, which was an accidental trip up to Northumberland and chatting to other medievalists. So what used to be a very closed world of academic communication, you know, this discovery's been made, this person comments on it, that's the end of it. It's now become this conversation, this global conversation, where people can add to it. Somebody's gone to their local archive and they've found this reference. Somebody else has been digging in another country and they're sharing finds that look similar to those in your area. So it's a very, very fast moving area at the moment, but the discipline hasn't kept up, I don't think. It has in articles, you know, but it's still a very disconnected academic world, I think. You know, somebody chooses whether they're going to be a scientist or whether they're going to study the humanities. And then inside the humanities, they choose whether they're going to look at art or literature, or they're going to look at, you know, material culture. And it's very, we wouldn't do that in our modern day, would we, Rich? We wouldn't say what it's like to be alive in 2022 can only be expressed through the fine art that's displayed, you know, in the local gallery. We wouldn't do that. We would look in an organic way and we'd pull together music, we'd pull together, you know, journalism and ideas. So that's what I'm trying to do with the past. I'm trying to texture it and use the evidence in a sort of more world building way. So each chapter starts with "You are now in 10th century Loftus," or "You are in 10th century Berger," or "You are in 14th century Kraków," and I try and put the figures into their environment as much as possible. But yeah, I mean, I think it was a risk. This book was a risk. I was scared when it was coming up to publication day. I was like, oh God, some, you know, because I've seen quite a few of these takedowns recently where, you know, an author's got a fact or a piece of information wrong, and then suddenly they've pulped the whole, you know, the whole set of books. It's like, don't, please, don't let that happen. So I was so neurotic. And it's like a third of the book is references and bibliography, just because I was like, please, please, I promise, I've done all my homework, I promise. But it is nerve-wracking to try and to try and put this out there. I didn't think it would be popular, but I thought it would make waves. But it's ended up making waves and being popular, which is quite amazing.
Yeah,
really.
it's done. Really, you know, it's been out for a few weeks, but you were in the Sunday Times bestseller list for 5 weeks, or is that still, could it still be ongoing, or is it dropped out after 5 weeks?
I don't know. I think it might have after 5 weeks. I don't know. Every week my publisher would ring me up in this sort of state of hysteria going, you will not believe it, we're in again. I mean, it's such an in many ways it's quite an esoteric book. It's quite detailed, it's quite I'm trying out some quite tricky methods in there, but I can't believe that people are actually just going, no, we'll buy it, we'll read it. It's fantastic. So yeah, I'm really, really excited. I do think that, you know, I make the claim right the way through the book, and I make the claim all the way through the back material of the book as well, that this is not all my research. This is a cumulative effect of me being able to digest and pull together decades of work by other academics in other fields. But I think it's these years I've been doing TV, these years I've been a sort of communicator, have benefited and allowed me to be a bit of a storyteller in this book as well, and weave the material together in my own way. So maybe that's why people are enjoying reading it, because it's got a storytelling element to it as well, hopefully.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it's, you know, but it's interesting to, because I think you want, as a reader of history, you want to know about more than just the stories you've heard before. And I think it is it's crazy that, as you say, it's 50% of the world's population that we know so little. Also, it does have a picture of a fanny on the front. I reckon that's probably why it's selling so well.
I know. Well, let's talk about the fanny. Yeah. It's, the fanny in the room. So it was really funny when I proposed this, because I knew. So you've already, we've talked about this before. Hildegard of Bingham is kind of the, like, take home figure of this book. You know, she's at the center of the book, and you get to Hildegard and you're like, no way could a woman this cool have lived in the 12th century. She's unbelievably cool. Polymath, you know, does all these incredible developments in science and music and language and art. But she made these images. They're from her first book, Scivias. And in her book, she goes to great pains to explain that this image is, in fact, the cosmic egg. And in the original, at the moment, you know, my name and title are in the center point. But in there, there's actually like a little coiled kind of whirlpool thing. Okay. And I remember looking at this being, yeah, sure, it's the four winds, it's the universe, it's all the rest of it. And then I was like, no, hang on a minute, this is so clearly, I mean, not only look at the hair around the edge, but also it's got all the salient kind of markers there. This is quite good handy kind of blueprint for a teenage boy. You know, this is what it looks like. If you hit these points, you're probably onto a winner. And also, it's not like I'm even extrapolating, because she wrote the first account of a female orgasm. So she knows about these things. She describes it. Shall I read it, Rich? Shall I find the...
Yeah, go on. Yes, please.
It's heady, heady stuff, isn't it? Where is it? Hang on, give me a sec.
Does the book fall open at that page for you? That's what... There'll be a lot of teenage boys for whom this book... This is the naked ape the copy my mum and dad had, pictures of naked men and women, then you turned it around, you saw their bottoms on the back.
No, my one
like
was,
that.
I went to a Catholic primary school and we used to have like a copy of the Bible hidden out under a log in the playground. And when would fall open on all the descriptions of sex and penises and things like that. So yeah, hang on, I'm still trying to. Yeah, so this is her description. So it's so as I mentioned, she is primarily a mystic and a theologian, but she also is seen still today in Germany as the founder of natural history, as this sort of really quite insightful medic, and she came up with cures and all the rest of it. And still to this day, herbologists use her cures. They work fine. They work well, apparently. And she, you know, she was working in the hospitals of the monasteries and convents that she was at. So she's learning a lot of this stuff by interacting with women and their bodies. But this is her description. 1150, first known description of what a female orgasm sounds like. When a woman is making love with a man, a sense of heat in her brain, which brings with it sensual delight, communicates the taste of that delight during the act and summons forth the emission of the man's seed. And when the seed has fallen into its place, that vehement heat descending from her brain draws the seed to itself and holds it, and soon the woman's sexual organs contract, and all the parts that are ready to open up during the time of menstruation now close in the same way as a strong man can hold something enclosed in his fist. Whoa, Hildegard.
Pretty good.
Pretty good. I mean, like, yeah, it's pretty much up there. It's her own vagina monologues. But yeah, it's very impressive that she, this. I mean, she's writing that, as I say, 1150, hundreds and hundreds of years ago, and she's a nun. So many of us would just think, well, how is a nun being able to write this? Where's she getting this description from? But I think that's the other thing that I'm trying to challenge in this book. A lot of our terms that we use today are projected backwards from our own point of view. So a nun today is somebody quite kind of restrained, and they've made a big life choice. They've cut themselves off from society. Nuns in the high medieval period when she's around, certainly, are the mavericks. They're the university lecturers. They're the writers. They're the thinkers. They're choosing a life without kids and husbands, but that's allowing them to then go on and become like the leading brains in their fields. So it's kind of just our modern notions have to be challenged as well. And she really does that. Boy, I mean, she she also gives them instructions for how to abort a child, which, you know, we're in 2022 today, and there's an issue over a woman's right to choose that. And yet, hundreds of years ago, this saint of the Catholic Church is giving very, very clear instructions on how to bring about an abortion. So, you know, I think that she's quite a exemplar in the book. But she lived to 81. She wrote tons. And because she recorded so much, you can hear her voice over the years sort of changing. You can hear, you know, when she's writing a scientific text, she's got a slightly different writing voice to when she's writing poetry, and then a different one to when she's writing theology. She's just so rich. She's so alive to me, you know.
apart from it being very sexy, what were the reasons for this stuff surviving when maybe other stuff wouldn't? Is it?
Yeah. Her reputation. I mean, she was from the very, very beginning, when she started writing in her 40s, like late 30s, early 40s, she got the support of the Pope. And then she got the support of the big names of the time, people like Bernard of Clairvaux, who was like the big guy, you know, the bestseller everybody wanted to be like. And then all these kings, and then the Emperor Barbarossa, they all start seeing her as this, they call her the prophet, the Sibyl of the Rhine, because she's got this sort of prophetic voice where she's not hiding herself away. She's yelling at the people in charge. She's telling the Pope what to do. She's telling the Emperor Barbarossa what to do. And as a result, her work was fiercely protected during her life, and then it was copied out afterwards and preserved in a sort of collected works, which even today, you know, I've been racking my brains, which I can't think of anyone else that today that would be able to do the kind of breadth of knowledge that she's got. She's just awesome.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact. You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
I mean, it sort of makes you wonder, like, especially with the things like the Vatican and the vast libraries that are there, but also with, you know, when we're talking about the Marjorie Kemp discovery and this stately home of this work that had otherwise been lost. Do you feel that there's potentially loads of other stuff out there that, that we will discover one day?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So one of the real trigger for why I started writing this book was, how many years ago now? Oh, maybe 7 years ago. I was asked to do a documentary on Julian of Norwich. And I hadn't even heard the name Julian of Norwich since my undergrad days, where I sort of was in this exceptionally nerdy book club, which medieval mystics book club. I mean, come on, this is such a niche Oxford kind of way to spend your lunch break. Yeah, let's sit around and talk about the cloud of unknowing. So I'd read it, but I'd read it at 18, and Revelations of Divine Love, her book, it just felt weird. Book of Marjorie Kemp I read at the same time, and it was so much more fun. I thought Marjorie was an absolute nutter, and I love the way she cries everywhere. I love the way she upstages everyone all the time. But Julian's book kind of just felt very calm, very placid, a bit repetitive, a bit boring. And then I got this email from the BBC going, "I don't suppose you've heard of Julian of Norwich." And I was like, "Oh my gosh, I have." So we're going to make this documentary about her. And then literally a few days later, I get a book, I get an email from a publisher saying, "I don't suppose you've heard of Julian of Norwich, have you?" I'm like, did you talk to each other, or is this just the stars aligning? Anyway, it turns out it was the stars aligning. And I spent about a year of my life really immersed in her work, in her life, trying to, again, understand this woman who would shut herself up in a single room for decades as an anchoress. You know, she was walled up and declared dead, essentially. They're given the last rites. And then she lives in this single room and she writes this incredible book. And so when I was tracing her and how she was preserved, how her name survived down the centuries, it's a really complicated web involving 18-year-old nuns escaping to France and sort of all this. It's very complicated tracing the roots of the text. But one of the things that I came away, we found the original handwritten notes of when the book was first transcribed, but I think we could still find her manuscript. So the documentary was called The Search for the Lost Manuscript. And I was in all these municipal libraries in France. I was sort of, some of them, I mean, honestly, we were going into some of these sort of town libraries that were completely affected by the revolution, what happened to the books after the French Revolution. Half of them, they've just got stacks of manuscripts in boxes that have never been catalogued. They're just gathering dust. Nobody's looked at them. And I just was in there going, "Oh God, can we just open the boxes? Because somewhere in here, there are going to be treasures." Things, I mean, that's the beauty of this area is, Ignatius Butler Bowden Brown found the Book of Marjorie Kemp looking for ping pong balls. But there are stately homes, there are private collections, there are so many places. And now that we have the internet, if somebody does find that manuscript, they can ping it out and go, "Hey, I just found this. What is it?" Send it to me on Twitter. I'll be like, yes, come on. Let's have a look at it. There it is. Lost manuscript. So yeah, it's exciting. I think I don't think there's a more exciting time to be studying the past than now, partly because our present is so incredibly complicated as well. And we're in a position of being, like I say, I've tried to bring inclusivity into this book because I think, you know, there are major things affecting the human species at the moment. One of them is our sense of identity and how we deal with individualism and diversity in the face of individualism. And the other one is the drift between left and right, you know, this extreme polarizing of ideologies that's taking place. And the third one is the environment. You know, we're on a burning planet. So those three things hang heavy in my head when I'm writing as a historian. I want to hit big topics that matter now. So this book was kind of that as well. It's trying to be a big book. It's trying to do a lot.
Yeah. No, but it does, and you know, you get on to looking at it, analysing the ethnic diversity of the population, of the British population in medieval times, because obviously that's the thing. People are upset about The Hobbit having. The Lord of the Rings having black people in it, and I've seen people seriously arguing about how that shouldn't be allowed because of the history of the stories.
You kind
of
unbelievable,
go, they're hobbits. But it's interesting that this DNA analysis and the analysis of graves can show, and of gender identity and the possibility. You know, as you talk about it, it's. They wouldn't have defined themselves by the words we necessarily use, but equally, it's clear that other things were going on, and you can discover. It's sort of wonderful that you could discover these things. I mean, DNA is such the most amazing tool in these terms. It's sort of unspoken, you know, this little hidden indicator however much we want to kind of try and hide history, you can't really. That's a sort of factual thing, right? If there's no truth, there is the truth of what the DNA shows you. No, so.
Except though, you see, this is me. We haven't even had anything to drink, and I'm already starting my angry pub conversation. So I would poke a little bit further at that as well, because, you know, that's what I do in the book. I sort of say, right, well, in the first couple of chapters, we've got all this material evidence, you know, coins and jewellery and things that could tell us about these women if we read it. And archaeologists have traditionally said if there's a sword in the burial, it's a man. If there's a string of beads, then it's a woman, nice and cut and dry. And so I lean into that as a way that it's traditionally been done as a sort of gender differentiation. Then I move into the Burqa warrior, and the Burqa warrior was a really big one because, you know, this individual is buried with, you know, two sacrificed horses and a full armory of weapons, you know, everything, bow and arrows, spears, swords, the works. And it was this DNA analysis just in 2019 that proved there was a double X chromosome throughout all of the samples, which says this person was female. But what I think is then I try and unpack, and again, all the way through the book, I'm looking at the ways that people message about themselves, you know, how people dress, how they wear their hair, you know, what jewelry they wear. That gender, again, is something else. Even if this character, this person, the Burqa warrior woman, has got two X chromosomes, how did she look? You know, I mean, we can look at fantasy. We can look at people like Brianna Tarr because, you know, you've got a fantasy character in Game of Thrones that's trying to show this complexity. But yeah, how did they think about themselves? What did they, you know, how would they have appeared to others? Those are things that are really hard to reconstruct from the past. And that's where the only way you can try and get close is by combining your disciplinary approaches. So someone like Hildegard, we've got all these words that she's left behind, all these texts. Someone like the Burqa warrior, we've got the bones, we've got the finds. But to really build up that three-dimensional character, can we ever do it? Can we ever truly find a person from the past? But then, you know, I was thinking about how we would do that today. I've just recently lost a dear friend and colleague, and their obituary was our version of the person I knew. But that doesn't mean that was the full person. And that doesn't take into account so many aspects of him that I knew that aren't coming through in that piece of text. Yeah. And that's kind of how I feel as a historian. You know, we will start to build these stories up and we'll put them back and we'll start talking about them and discussing them. But you're only ever going to be getting glimpses. But then that's the fun, isn't it? That's the detective novel of it all.
It is. And history serves a purpose beyond, as you say, beyond truth. And that it's, I mean, the Hedwig, Jadwiga, is that how you say it?
Jadwiga, very good.
Yeah, who was the king of Poland, even though she was a woman. You know, she becomes a symbol of so much more to the Polish people than any person could ever be. And so, you know, so as interesting and amazing as her life is, what we know of it, in depth and throughout and through history, you can only become a sort of a sketch of what the person was, and then possibly not even what the person, you know, what the person represents or what the person has come to represent. And you see that in Roman history all the time, I suppose, as each Caesar goes, their reputation changes, and the next one. Well, and in your book, you talk about Alfred the Great's daughter,
Well with Jadwiga. Now you're getting stuck on
this. Aethelflaed, I'm going to say. Aethelflaed.
Aethelflaed.
Flaed is an L. I can't read my own writing. but like her brother kind of changing her reputation. When if she hadn't died, she could equally have been seen as the person who united England.
Absolutely. I mean, so many things you've said there, which are relevant. I'm going to pick you up and say congratulations on saying Jadwiga correctly, because that year, that Polish year, which is actually a J, this takes me right back. I said I would come back to my Janina Ramirez, and I will, because so I'm married to a Spaniard. Yes. And I used to have a very Polish sounding surname, Malecek. It was all C's and Z's. And when I got married quite young, and I said to my parents, I'm going to take my husband's name. You know, I like the name Ramirez. And they were up in arms. No, you're losing your Polish surname. I said, listen, don't worry. I'm going to keep Janina as my first name. Very clearly Polish. You know, it'll confuse everybody every time they read it. They'll think it's Janina. It's, you know, it means I get to, you know, really, truly express my Polish roots. And when I graduated for my PhD, my parents had come up to York. They were all excited. I sat in the audience with my now husband. And the lady goes to them, can we call up Janina Ramirez? And my parents both just looked at me and went, oh, what? So that's why I was like, yeah, I'm going to pick you up with Janina. But yeah, Jadwiga is fascinating, because Jadwiga, like, actually, it matters so much. I have been to her tomb at Wawel. I had the little prayer card with her on it. And she, you see it so often. So my first big academic book I wrote was called The Private Lives of Saints. And in a funny way, I was already doing what I'm doing in this book there, because I was taking these people we know as Saint Hilda, Saint Wilfred, Bede the Venerable, and then kind of say, well, actually, they're real people who lived in a real environment, and let's try and understand them in their time and what they were like. And that was what I was trying to do with Jadwiga. She's become this sort of not only a Catholic saint, but also a symbol of nationalism, a rallying point of identity, cultural identity. And to take someone like that and go, well, hang on a minute, she lived in this landscape, this is what she held, this was her bag, this was her, you know, these are the things she owned, these are the things she touched. That's again sort of pushing the boundaries of where I think history should be going. I think we should always be challenging the historical facts on which our myths and legends are founded. You know, we build nations, we go to war on the basis of historical stories and how they have fed into who we are as people. So shouldn't we challenge the facts behind them? Shouldn't we look and see if the thing we're fighting for is actually founded on truth? whatever truth is. But you know, it's so Jadwiga's really interesting. But you mentioned Aethelflaed. Aethelflaed is epic. And this is another thing I had to address. So all the way through the book, I'm standing on the shoulders of giants or giantesses. And one of the big books I read in the build-up to getting ready to start Feminar was Henrietta Leysner's Social History of Medieval Women. And in that, it's a huge encyclopedic book. It lists every woman we have a reference to, almost, it feels like. But she still does the same thing that you see again and again, right back to Eileen Power's book on medieval women, which is that they're sort of given titles which are mother, sister, aunt, wife. And those tend to be the brackets. And then you're like, okay, so these were all wives. These were all kind of princesses married to you know, rich people. And that's what I wanted to challenge. And with Æthelflæd, she's all of those things. But the thing that comes out more importantly to me is she's a military leader. She's a diplomat. She is a civic development officer. She knows how to develop city planning. She's a patron of the arts. She's, you know, knows all these different languages. She also, a bit like Hildegard, she has one child, just a daughter, Alfwin. And then she refuses to have any more because she doesn't want to die in childbirth. And she doesn't, you know, she thinks she's done enough. She has essentially, as far as she's concerned, her role of Lady of the Mercians will pass directly to her daughter, which indeed it did for the only time in English history. And that's enough because there is an heir and the heir is female. And this is like, you know, this is in the 9th, 10th century. So that's huge. Even today, you know, you've got Wills and Kate having to sign multiple documents about who's going to inherit when they've got a son and a daughter. But Æthelflæd was like, nope, got one daughter. That's enough. She's going to get it. Sort it out when I'm gone. And you're right. It's her brother. It's the naughty Edward who is responsible for kind of casting her reputation in a different direction. Mm-hmm. But there are Irish annals, there are Norse documents, there is all this material evidence, and there's the one that she left behind herself, the Æthelflæd annals, which is so funny. This is why I love the Æthelflæd annals, because it's a complete reversal of all other chronicles. In all other chronicles, you'll get, Alfred the Great, his wife is barely mentioned in all the texts about him, but occasionally they'll get a mention like, she had a baby. Great. And then all the rest of it's about Alfred. In the Æthelflæd Chronicles, her husband, Æthelred, who was the Lord of the Mercians, it's the whole book is about her. And there's only three references. And that's when he gets married, they have the baby, and then he dies. And it's like, ah, oh, that's how every other woman has been chronicled. I love it. It feels so deliberate on her part. It's like, no, you don't need to know about him. Don't need to know about him. He's in the background. Don't worry about the husband. So there's all these stories. I suppose this is not a definitive history. I'm not trying to kind of block out everything from 600 to 1400 in a chronological way, but I'm trying to show that we can just cast different put different lenses on the past, look in different ways. And I think it's so much more fun. The discovery element is just really, really fun. I'm loving it.
It's extraordinary. I have to say, as wonderful a feminist work is, and as interesting as it is to hear all these stories of women, the bit that that most spoke to me, and that I then mentioned on the podcast when down the hill and talked to Tim Key about it, was how many penises there are on the Bayeux tapestry. That was my favourite. Although the whole story of the making of the Bayeux tapestry and the reaction to the penises throughout history is very interesting in itself. But I was glad
not in the least bit surprised? That is so funny. I'm not surprised, Rich. I have seen your multiple penis doodles. I wasn't going to say your multiple penises. No, I have not seen all the penises. But no, oh God, I'm so sorry. Hang on, my phone is going, I'm so sorry. Sorry. Cut that, edit. No, that's so funny you say that, because when I was in the recording booth doing the Audible book, I had this awesome sound technician. He was really, really lovely. And he was this big sort of rock dude. And he was in his booth and he had to sit and listen to me for, you know, every day for 8, 9, 10 hours. And it was exactly the same. When we got to the Bayeux tapestry section, I started reading out the statistics about penises and how many penises are on the horses and how big the penises on the horses are. And he was literally in the cans in my headphones going, no way, no way, no way. And then he came in the next day and he went, I went home and I spent the whole of the dinner telling my wife and children about penises. I really did not think that'd be the take home about my book. But
that's for the guys, you know, that's the guys. That's where we are. Unfortunately, we're still there. There's a bit about us.
Shalom.
Let's take that home.
It was, I mean, I think that's so, again, I did it on purpose in a way, because it's like that whole, it was that thing about The Bayeux Tapestry is a super, super macho event, isn't it? It is, you know, willy waving. And I love the fact that the penis on William the Conqueror's horse is ever so slightly longer than the penis on Harold Godwinson's horse. Yeah. But they're both pretty good because, you know, these are two rivals up against each other. But it is, it's blood and guts. I mean, I went to see the one in Reading, actually. I think I said this to you before, but, you know, ever kicking about Reading Station. Walk out, pop into Reading Museum, you've got a full scale reconstruction of the Bayeux Tapestry there. I have spent many a late night in Reading Station, but it's overwhelming when you stand in front of it and you see it unrolled like that, because the one in Bayeux is sort of done on an arc and I don't think you get the same impact. The one in Reading is literally done on a rectangle as it would have been in Bayeux Cathedral, which I kind of argue in the book. And you get this cinematic sense. You're standing in front of the ships, for example, and the marges disappear, and you've just got you can see how the ships look like they're moving over the canvas. And then the battle takes place, and you've got these organized margins all the way through that have these lovely little birds and little fables taking place, and occasionally naked people. I'm sure that you noticed that bit as well, Rich. but then in the battle scenes, those margins sort of vanish, and the bodies start to spill out into the margins. So you've got like decapitated corpses, and you've got one figure ripping the chainmail off another. Are in them in the edges, so it's like, and the horses are tumbling and flipping over in out, spilling out off the edges of the image, and I just think that is like, it's like a movie. It's absolutely amazing. But the thing everybody thinks when they're looking at this, and I'm guilty of this. I've been teaching about the Bayeux Tapestry for decades. I've been researching it for decades. What's the first thing that comes to mind is not the people that made it, but I argue in the book, you know, if you stood in front of a painting by Van Gogh, or you know you're looking at the Mona Lisa, the thing that you would say is, oh gosh, I'd really like to understand more about Leonardo da Vinci, or I'd really like to understand the artist. Nobody stands in front of the Bayeux Tapestry and go, I wonder what women made this. And that's, I was just being provocative. I started off the whole chapter just being provocative, saying, well, it's a mistress piece, not a masterpiece, and it's what you can't see. Every single stitch that went into that linen was held by the hand of a woman. And a nun, no less, you know, again, it's these nuns, you know, picking out penises stitch by stitch carefully and drawing decapitated corpses and blood and war. And so let's think about them. Let's think about the artists. So again, I'm constantly being provocative all the way through, but I'm glad that you enjoyed the statistics. That's good conversation.
but it did make you think, you know, it did make you think about the women who made it. And I wasn't really, I was, you know, I've been to see the Bayeux Tapestry year when I was a kid. It's not a tapestry. I got Tim Key because he thought it was a tapestry and it's an embroidery, so I made him look stupid.
Excellent, always a good feeling. Always.
And but I didn't know, you know, I didn't know it was. I must have known someone down the line, but I kind of had forgotten that it was an English creation, and you know, made in, you say Canterbury properly is probably what you say.
So certainly like the ideas are coming out of Canterbury, and again you get this sense of a collaboration on a massive project today. You know, when we look at like how a big posh skyscraper is going to be built and how the interior designers are going to kit it out and, you know, what materials they're going to use for the floors, we think about those things as collaborative. But when you see something like the Bayeux Tapestry, we don't think about the levels of collaboration that go into making that. But what I'm arguing is, you know, you've got the abbot at Canterbury with his big group of monks, and they've got all these manuscripts that they're looking at and getting ideas, and then they're sending over cartoons over to this incredibly kind of powerful abbess who is then putting together her crack team of embroiderers and getting the material imported and trying to get all the different dyes and the different you know, it's a huge industrial scale project. And so it's trying to get that sense as well about it not necessarily being so gendered. This is a collaboration. Again, I think it's trying to bring that world to life, that these we tend to think of an abbot and a bunch of monks, oh, they would never have anything to do with nuns. No, they should never the twain shall meet. But they're constantly interacting. They're constantly having stuff to do with each other. They're, you know, they're the big thinking pods of the Middle Ages. They're where medicine's taking place, where books are being written. They're like the publishing houses, the Silicon Valley, all wrapped up in these, what we call a monastery or a convent. But that's where I'd have been. That's where you'd have found me, I tell you. No way I'm peasanting about in the fields. I'm off to a monastery, a convent, going to read all day.
But also, it's again, it's sort of just luck that it survived. I had an image that it's been protected and looked after all the centuries, and it's sort of just been used to cover up stuff and Vinland, and you know, could easily have been lost. So it's just chance that that survives. And again, it makes you realise how much of history is just nonsense. You know, Alfred burning the cakes is just, I was just thinking, you know, his daughter didn't have a story like that, but of course that never happened.
Yeah.
And King Canute turning the water back. They've all got these stories. And Harold being hit in the eye with an arrow is most people's understanding of history. And that didn't happen. And that's not even, you know, and that's a misreading of the tapestry. So
that was the other moment where my sound guy on the Audible call went, no way! He could not get over the fact that Harold wasn't shot in the eye by an arrow. And it's, you know, but I remember the first time I read that in an academic article, I was like, you're kidding me. Harold isn't the one with the arrow in his eye. And it's like, it's the same old thing that I keep having to tell people, well, the Vikings didn't have horns on a helmet. Still, I insist on having it either tattooed on my forehead or, I don't know, just sent out universally. The Vikings didn't have horns on their helmets. But in the book, I've had to put these things in. I'm like, right, do not ask me again because they didn't. And here is the evidence. And you're absolutely right. You know, these things are truisms. We're told that they are true. And Alfred didn't burn the cakes, and Canute didn't turn back the waves. And you know, why? Let's get to the facts behind that. If I just said that to you, you'd be like, oh, that's, you know, what are you founding that on? So what I'm trying to do in the book is go, well, this is what I'm founding it on, material evidence, stuff I can point to. The stuff about Harold with the arrow, though, is amazing, isn't it? It's interesting.
Well, it really made me want to, I mean, it's not just the Bay of Tapestry, but I enjoyed that. I would just like to clarify that I was joking. But it did really make me think, oh, I really want to kind of go and look and research this further, because there were so many fascinating things just about the the way it's been bodged and redone, and you know, but yeah, absolutely, and all the history of it. I thought it was something, again, it's something you think you know about, and and it's such a famous artifact, and then you think there's actually so much more to this than I mean, your book does a fantastic job of giving that history, but it made me want to look further into that, which is obviously fantastic. I mean, we have only scratched the surface of this book, and there's so many more stories. We haven't even mentioned all the women that you mentioned, so which is good, because I want people to go and read the book. But I very much enjoyed it, and it is very in it. It does make you stop and think about many, many things, and it's great. So everyone should buy it and listen to it, and you can listen to Nina reading it out herself, as I did. And your enthusiasm is always a fantastic thing, Nina. I think it's absolutely lovely to hear you read it yourself as well. So do buy it. It's out now, so you can. It's been out for a little while. Have you been? Is there any books you're reading that you would like to recommend, or have you read anything recently, or do you just write?
I am. I have had what I would describe as a brain dead summer. The book came out at the very, very start of the summer holidays, and then it went stellar, and I'm starting to get all these, oh my God, instant bestseller, rest of it. And I just went, right, I have to pause my brain. So I have been so dumb this summer. I've been like, all I've managed to do is watch box sets, and I've done some tapestries. can't quite keep the medievalist out of me. But no, I have actually, one thing I did get was my lovely friend Lucy Worsley. She has a beautiful new book out about Agatha Christie. And it's really lovely. It's a traditional biography, which I don't usually read. I don't usually read a person's life from birth to death. And they're not my bag usually. But I really found this one. I've been really enjoying that. And it's the sort of book that I feel like it's sort of like a film unfolding before my eyes. So I've been enjoying Lucy's book. And yes, I have. I mean, as much as I haven't been reading, I've been looking at medieval texts like the nerd that I am, because I'm doing some work on Beowulf. So I've gone back to Beowulf for like the 800th time and read that. So I haven't been quite brain dead, but yes, good. I would recommend those.
I've got Lucy's book on order, so I mean, I'll try and tap you up for an email address so I can ask her to come on here. That would be good. If I enjoy the only if I enjoy the book, I don't have any old. If I read it and don't like it, I'll say no.
Oh well, in that respect, I'm very honoured. That means that
you are very honest.
Genuinely like the book. You came along to the launch party and drank all the free wine, so you've got to say it now.
My wife drank the one. I no longer drink, so I drank,
oh yes, of course. She
I drank some water. My wife made up
the
for it.
The team made up for it. There was a very good team effort that night in terms of partying.
It was very good fun. It was very good fun. Look, always lovely to talk to you. Thank you so much for coming on and talking the book. And you know, I don't need to ask. Wish you good luck for the book because it's also already doing fantastically. But it's called Femina. Janina Ramirez. Ramirez. I'll try and say that as, how can I say Ramirez in Polish? I can't do it.
As anglicized as possible, yeah.
I'll be cancelled if I attempt it. Thank you very much. And I'd also like to thank Chris Evans, not that one, for his fantastic work in putting this together. Thank you very much. We'll be back next week. Do I know who it's going to be next week yet? Yeah, it's Fergus Craig next week because I've just talked to him. I've talked to him already before you, but it's going out after you. Weird. Yeah,
I got pushed up the listings.
Yeah, it's quite a different book to yours, I would say. Murder in Crime Manor, but then you can do your homework and read that before.
I will.
Thank you very much. I'd love to see you. Thank you. Goodbye.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thanks for listening. RichardHerring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.